This is Al Reynolds from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I shall share with you the Triangle Business Journal, dated March 29th. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. Today's top story, top of the fold, law office deals spark Raleigh market. By Amanda Jones Hoyle from Raleigh. The Wyrick Robbins Law Firm, which last year set off a local real estate rush when the partners started looking at options to relocate, has decided to eschew the allure of a slew of new buildings being proposed around the region. The Raleigh firm instead will renovate and expand its offices in the Summit Building on Lake Boone Trail that it has occupied for 23 years. But sources say at least 8 other major law firms in the region that are also nearing the end of their lease contracts might not be as content to stay where they are. A decision by any of these firms to move could be the spark that real estate developers need to start construction of Raleigh's first major office building in at least 3 years. Law firms have a tendency to drive new development in any city, says Don Shoup, a broker with CBRE Raleigh. Like financial institutions, law firms are very attractive to developers. They typically sign long-term deals, and they usually require an amount of space that a developer can assemble a tenant base around. Johnny Loper, managing partner for the Raleigh office of Womble, Carlisle, Sandridge & Rice, says his firm's lease for 68,000 square feet in the Wells Fargo Capital Center building in downtown Raleigh doesn't expire until the end of 2015. But that's not a lot of time if you have to be in a different building that's not been built yet, he says. Loper notes that the firm's leadership is perfectly happy in the office tower that they have occupied for more than 20 years, but they still want to evaluate their options, including new office buildings that are being planned in downtown Raleigh, North Hills, Glenwood Avenue, and at Glenlake Office Park. Following in Womble Carlisle's footsteps is the Brooks Pierce Law Firm that also occupies space in the Wells Fargo Capital Center downtown tower, located at 150 Fayetteville Street. Walter Douglas, Director of Administration for the Greensboro-based firm, says the firm currently occupies about 27,000 square feet in the building and needs to expand. Its lease term runs through September 2015. We are just beginning the process right now of deciding whether to move, build, or stay where we are, Douglas says. We definitely need more space, and we anticipate needing even more space as we grow. But we need more space right now. A third law firm in the Wells Fargo Capital Center building could also be moving out later this year. Sources say that the Parker Poe Law Firm has signed a deal to relocate to 2 floors in the PNC Plaza Tower building in downtown Raleigh. But Parker Poe's managing partner, Kevin Schignall, declined to comment. Recent real estate sources also say the K&L Gates Law Firm may be looking to move into a bigger space at North Hills in the future. The firm currently occupies about 39,000 square feet of space above retail shops at North Hills. Michelle Richgood, owner of Rich Commercial Realty in Raleigh, who has represented several law firms in the Triangle, including Womble Carlisle, in their negotiations of office deals, says law firms bring a lot to the table with a landlord. They are very valued clients and usually sign long-term leases, she says, but law firms also generally want to get the best terms possible that are available to them. Wyrick Robbins' partner, Larry Robbins, says his firm did a thorough search of its options in the Triangle office market before deciding to renew and expand its lease in the Summit Building for another 12 years. On the firm's short list, he says, was Kane Realty's Tower 2 building at North Hills, Highwoods Properties' next building at Glen Lake Office Park, and Grubb Ventures' proposed 3800 Glenwood building. We talked to a lot of great developers with great desirable locations, but at the end of this, this is the place we are comfortable with and our clients are comfortable with, says Robbins. Other local law firms that have recently signed long-term lease contracts to renew or relocate in the Triangle include 1. The Teague Campbell Law Firm's pending move in August from 4800 Six Forks Road to the 4700 Falls Office Building on Falls of Neuse Road. 2. The Smith Dedham Law Firm's lease renewal at 4601 Six Forks Road. And 3. The Hutchinson Law Group's move this summer from 5410 Trinity Road into 12,000 square feet in the 3110 Edwards Mill Road building. Ellison Winters' managing partner Mike Winters says his firm's lease at 1100 Crescent Green Drive in Cary has been extended through February 2015, but the firm has made no comment or commitment beyond that. We are considering our options, he says. For larger chunks of space, there are not as many options available as there used to be. It would have been better to be in the market 2 years ago. Next up, cutting costs, modest hiring delivers profits. By Chris Bagley from Raleigh. Business has picked up modestly for a wide range of companies in the last year, but their public filings reveal they've been more profitable mainly by keeping a lid on cost. 13 of the Triangle's largest publicly traded companies increased their revenue by an average of about 4.4% to a total of $16.9 million in their most recent fiscal years. In contrast, their net income grew by 146%. Employee compensation is the largest expense for most companies, and that fact is reflected in the modest hiring by large publicly traded concerns that are based here. Their most recent annual reports show a total of about 35,100 employees, just 1,500 more than they reported in their previous round of annual reports. That 4.3% growth rate lags just behind revenue growth. Economists point to economic uncertainty as a brake on hiring at many companies. In the meantime, employees and employers alike are a bit more than 4% to about 35,100 full-time equivalent employees based on numbers in the company's annual reports. Total profit per employee more than doubled to $17,414 in the most recent set of fiscal years from $7,400 in the previous one. For most companies, current profitability isn't the main factor in deciding when and how many to hire, of course, and any one company's net income can vary from 1 year to the next as a result of one-time accounting charges that don't relate to how busy its employees are. Nevertheless, the changing totals square with federal data on labor productivity and the comments of economists and people in the human resources field, which all point to companies doing more with less. East Carolina University economist James Cleckley says the key factor is employers' uncertainty about what will come next. That's particularly true in regions that are more heavily dependent on federal spending, such as eastern North Carolina, where large numbers of civilian employees work directly or indirectly for military bases. The underlying problem is really uncertainty about the future, and that goes back to Washington, D.C., says Cleckley, director of ECU's Bureau of Business Research. If you're going to invest in an employee, you want to know where there will be a payoff. That's really slowed down a lot of the hiring. Tax rates, healthcare costs, and much more could change in the next couple of years, Cleckley notes. One particularly profitable local company is Investors Title Company, whose net income rose by more than 50% in 2012 to $11.2 million. The company has also been hiring, albeit more modestly. It had 205 full-time employees and 7 part-timers as of December 31st. That works out to about $53,700 in net income per FTE employee, if you count part-timers as working 20 hours a week. The ratio was up about 50% from 2011. We do run lean, says Mitchell Ward, the Chapel Hill-based company's vice president of human resources. The company's been hiring out of necessity as business picks up in a fairly labor-intensive industry, she says. It's something we take very seriously, she says. Employees across the nation have become steadily more productive over the decades thanks to rising education levels and companies' investments in improving technology. Data from the U.S. Labor Department show employees' output growing by 2.9% in 2012, while they worked in a total of about 2.2% more hours than in 2011. The difference, 0.7%, reflects improving productivity. Over time, that has translated into higher wages. Average wages, however, fell last year after taking inflation into account. Productivity would be improving more quickly, and wages would be rising at least modestly if companies were investing in more technology and equipment, says Clark Ross, a Davidson College economist who studies labor markets. But companies are holding back on capital expenditures for some of the same reasons they're holding back on hiring, he says. Capital spending was down by about 4% among publicly traded companies in the Triangle, according to a TBJ analysis in September. Firms are more hesitant to expand labor than after previous recessions, Ross says. We're seeing, with this recession, unemployment not falling as rapidly. Inside the front page, budget reveals governor's bent. McCrory pulling money in that's now going to nonprofits for distribution. By Lee Weisbecker. This article is from Raleigh. Embracing a different idea about how state government ought to work, Governor Pat McCrory and his budget director, Art Pope, have shown their willingness to step on toes. Millions in state dollars that went out each year to high-profile nonprofits and trusts to spark economic development, preserve land, and help minorities, for instance, are being pulled back into the state's general fund. Once that money is back in the central coffer, it will be up to lawmakers to decide how the tax dollars and other cash are used moving forward, but in transparent votes recorded for all to see. Some of the money might indeed find its way back to economic development or land preservation and the like, just without the middlemen. True transparency is how Pope describes it. It's a new way of doing business in Raleigh, but one that won't be put into place without upsetting a number of apple carts. I think this is more about philosophy, that all funds should be routed through the state budget, says Dan Gerlich, whose Rocky Mount-based Golden Leaf Foundation is looking at cuts totaling $130 million over the next 2 years. I disagree, however, with the philosophy, he says. In the $20 billion budget plan McCrory sent to the General Assembly, a slate of other groups are also being squeezed. The proposed cut to one shows how the new approach works. Set up in 1994 to finance improvements to state parks, the North Carolina Parks and Recreation Trust sees all of its $27.5 million annual state appropriation rolled back into the general fund. At the same time, the agency spokesman, Charles Peake, the administration, is recommending that $15.5 million plus be returned to finance operations of the trust next year. Other outside groups apparently won't fare as well. McCrory and Pope would slash roughly 60% of the current state support to both the North Carolina Biotechnology Center and the North Carolina Rural Center, two nonprofits that, over the years, essentially have become quasi-state economic development agencies. Each loses $20 million over 2 years under the governor's budget. Explaining the moves, McCrory spokeswoman Crystal Feldman returns to the open government theme, saying the reductions are being made to bring more transparency to the state's economic development efforts and centralize them within the Commerce Department, as opposed to sending money to entities outside the state government. In defending some of the cuts, Pope also went on record saying that the groups, including the Golden Leaf Foundation and the Rural Center, have the cash on hand to move forward. Golden Leaf's option would be to use returns from its large investment portfolio, $790 million in June of 2012, to continue its mission of making economic development grants in the rural communities. That might be easier to do in some years than others, however. Investment returns were negative, $9.2 million in 2012, whereas in the prior year they had been positive, $120 million. The Rural Center, by contrast, has no endowment, says spokesman Matt Ellers. The organization, whose revenue stream also includes federal grants and corporate donations, is currently assessing the likely impact of the state cuts, he says. Next up, with Oracle's buy, Tekelec's future unclear, by Lauren K. Onisorge. This article is from Morrisville. For a company that started in aviation electronics and transformed with the times into a telecom equipment maker, Tekelec has more than just its 600 employees in Morrisville. It has a history of local growth. Despite having changed leadership and business plans multiple times since its founding more than 40 years ago, a workforce in Morrisville has remained strong and steady for decades. The company has responded to the increase in mobile traffic and now creates tools for telecoms to manage and monetize that mobile data. But due to a highly touted acquisition by California networking giant Oracle, that future, at least locally, is uncertain despite a business-as-usual statement from both companies following the acquisition announcement on March 25th. That means both companies will continue to operate independently until the transaction closes. After that, well, no one from either Oracle or Tekelec would comment specifically, but in a customer presentation, Oracle said to expect Tekelec managemental team and employees to join the Oracle Communications Global Business Unit and continue their focus on delivering excellence to service providers after the transaction closes. Oracle also plans to increase investments in Tekelec products in order to deliver what it is calling the communications industry's most complete portfolio. Together with Oracle, we expect to accelerate the pace of service innovation by helping service providers transform the way they manage and monetize the explosive growth in signaling and data traffic on their networks, says Tekelec CEO Ron DeLange in a statement. The combination of Oracle and Tekelec will provide service providers with the most complete solution to manage their businesses across customer engagement, business and network operations, service delivery, and end-user applications, says Bhaskar Gorti, Senior Vice President and General Manager of Oracle Communications. Dana Cooperson, Principal Analyst at Ovum, says the acquisition is a play by Oracle to move into the heart of telecom networks, adding that Tekelec's technology will extend Oracle's network control capabilities. Cooperson says the acquisition also illustrates that the industry recognizes software to be a key driver of network capabilities. Cooperson's colleague, analyst Matt Walker, says to expect more telecom IT crossover. But how much presence does Oracle need to maintain in the triangle to absorb the company's technologies? For Tekelec's local employees, that's an important question that won't be answered until the acquisition closes, if then. Tekelec leases 315,000 square feet of space from Duke Realty on Paramount Parkway in Morrisville. That lease expired in 5 years. In the meantime, the acquisition could be a wake-up call to both Oracle's telecom-focused competitors such as Alcatel-Lucent, as well as its IT-focused competitors. Cooperson mentions Caribe SaaS as one of those IT-focused companies, saying to expect SaaS to do more strategic soul-searching and, as their financial situation allows, to pursue acquisitions of their own. Tekelec also provides a patent portfolio numbering in the hundreds to its new parent. In 2011 alone, the company obtained 18 local patents. It has 100 North Carolina patents in the last 5 years. It is the second acquisition for Tekelec of late, as it was acquired by a consortium led by Cirrus Capital Group in January of 2012 for $780 million. Next up, a pair of articles about hospitals. The first one will be about Rex Hospital. The second one will be about WakeMed. And they're both entitled Your Heart, Their Business. Hospitals take off gloves and vow to best the other in cardiac care. This first article is about Rex Hospital and was written by Jason DeBruin. When Rex Hospital opens its new heart tower in 3 years, hospital leaders say it will shift the center of heart and vascular care away from WakeMed and towards Rex. "I don't think there is any question about that," says Dr. Bill Newman, a co-founder of Wake Heart and Vascular, which is now affiliated with Rex, especially when this facility is built. Rex Healthcare, a subsidiary of UNC Healthcare, performed 3,100 cardiovascular procedures in 2012, but provides those services in 7 different areas on the campus off Blue Ridge Road in Raleigh. In some cases, patients must be wheeled nearly a half a mile across the campus to move through the process of care. Clearly, that's not efficient, nor is it comfortable for the patient, says Dr. James Sitter, president of Rex Heart and Vascular, a group of 8 cardiovascular specialists at Rex. The word efficient came up several times in relation to the new tower, which will cost an estimated $279 million and open in 2016. Rex will not add any beds to the 433 it currently counts, so it won't increase revenue or increase services in that way. But because of greater efficiencies, the hospital will be able to perform more procedures, see more patients, and increase revenue, says Eric Hawkins, UNC Healthcare Vice President over Heart and Vascular Services. The tower, which Rex will build where a parking deck now sits, will include 115 of the 433 beds dedicated to cardiovascular care, leaving 318 for other services in the main hospital. The tower is only one part of Rex's desire to grow its cardiovascular care. Among others, Rex recruited Sitter from the Duke Healthcare System to start Rex Heart and Vascular. It also brought Newman and Wake Heart and Vascular, which had been an independent group that helped build WakeMed's heart business, under its wings. Those doctors are now Rex employees. I think this Rex's heart initiatives will attract a lot of attention statewide and nationally, says Newman, accentuating the connection between the cardiologist in Raleigh and the academic physicians with the UNC School of Medicine. I think you are combining the benefits of high volume and technical skills of a teaching facility, he says. This is going to be an extraordinary facility. And now, WakeMed story. Leaders at WakeMed say Rex Hospital's $279 million investment in heart care comes 15 years after what it already achieved and will only catch up Rex to WakeMed's offerings. We're the Coca-Cola of cardiovascular care, and we are going to maintain our brand, says Dr. Richard Dahl, an expert cardiologist with WakeMed Faculty Physicians, Raleigh Cardiology. We are out in front as a cardiovascular leader, and we are going to stay out in front as a leader with different and new thinking. With 217 of its 870 hospital beds dedicated to cardiovascular care, WakeMed Health and Hospitals now and will continue to boast heart service capacity near twice what Rex will offer. Occupancy at WakeMed's Raleigh campus consistently runs at 90% or more, and has been increasing steadily and sharply at the Cary campus, says Betsy Gaskins-McLean, WakeMed Heart and Vascular Vice President. To drive the point home, she said on March 27th, the day she was interviewed, the hospital was at 100% capacity. WakeMed and Rex came to a mutual agreement in their fight over Rex's bid to build the Heart Tower, but negotiations happened behind closed doors and no one with knowledge of the talks at either hospital would offer any details about the discussions. WakeMed has long been considered the market leader in heart services, and the move by Rex could be seen as an infringement on that lucrative market. Even if that's how Rex officials see it, those at WakeMed don't sound concerned. The hospital system has poured hundreds of millions of dollars into its heart care, and they say they see Rex's new heart tower as simply an attempt to catch up, not overtake, WakeMed. WakeMed performs the most heart procedures in the state, and now it wants to focus on bringing heart and vascular services to the primary care setting, says Stan Taylor, WakeMed's Vice President for Corporate Planning. I think we are seeing some sea changes in cardiac care, he says. We're seeing more of a focus on keeping people out of the hospital and getting them at the primary care level rather than coming in and doing a lot of procedures. We are much more focused on helping people manage their health rather than continuing to develop more buildings and more programs. In fact, that's a reason Daw says he stayed behind. For years, Daw worked with Wake Heart and Vascular, which in 2011 moved under the UNC Rex umbrella. But he stayed with WakeMed because he preferred the heart offerings here. We have great colleagues over there, so I don't want to be the negative towards Rex, he said, adding, WakeMed is the leader and is going to continue to be the leader in heart care. Moving deeper inside this week's TBJ, we find another article entitled, Blue Cross Grows Share in Medicare Advantage, by Jason DeBrun from Chapel Hill. Blue Cross and Blue Shield of North Carolina, the state's largest health insurer, has grown its Medicare Advantage population at a steep clip and now sits as the state's market leader in that subset of covered lives. Sometimes referred to as Medicare Part C, those on Medicare Advantage access health insurance through a private insurer as opposed to directly from the federal government as with other Medicare plans. The private insurer then deals directly with health care providers to pay medical bills and receives a monthly reimbursement from the federal government. Last year, Chapel Hill-based Blue Cross Blue Shield of North Carolina increased its Medicare Advantage enrollment by 37% to 114,000 members. That's good enough for a 34.2% market share, up from the 27% market share it had in 2011, and now tops among insurers in the state. That overall enrollment has grown is no surprise. As the baby boomer generation ages into retirement and qualifies for Medicare, those ranks are growing nationwide. Medicare is not exclusively for the elderly, though. They make up the majority of enrollees. A growing market share is of note, however, since the future of reimbursements for these plans is cloudy. Enrollment in these plans has been increasing since 2004. That year, there were 5.3 million Americans enrolled in private plans, according to data compiled by the Kaiser Family Foundation. That grew to an enrollment of $13.1 million by 2012. Nationwide, 27% of Medicare beneficiaries are enrolled in Medicare Advantage, though in North Carolina, that percentage is only 19%. Under the Affordable Care Act, sometimes called Obamacare, Medicare Advantage reimbursements to private insurers will be cut. How much it is still known, but the cut will bring reimbursements more in line with traditional Medicare costs. The ACA still allows for insurers with high-quality ratings to earn larger bonuses. Following this Medicare market growth just makes sense for us, says Charlene Foley, Blue Cross Blue Shield's director of marketing, noting that her company's plans are currently highly rated. She admits that the future benefit could be reduced, however. Private insurers can make money in these plans by managing a covered life efficiently. If the insurer can spend less in medical bills than it collects from Medicare, it's a net positive. Blue Cross Blue Shield North Carolina files as a not-for-profit organization, and as such shies away from the term profit. The difference is usually accounted for as revenue over expenses. Blue Cross Blue Shield of North Carolina does not break out Medicare Advantage financials. According to the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, the average per member per month payment from the government to the insurers between $700 and $800 in North Carolina. Payments differ based on plan design and county of residence. The North Carolina Department of Insurance encourages those considering a Medicare Advantage plan to read carefully what the plan offers before signing up, according to information provided by Carrie Hall. A spokeswoman for the department, customers should know if there are copayments, for example, or monthly premiums. Also, know what doctors accept, various plans, and where the plans are available. This week's column on transportation is by Chris Bagley. It's entitled Airports Shifting Costs to Passengers, and it's from Morrisville. Under pressure from penny-pinching airlines, airports are turning toward passengers as their main source of revenue through services like parking and restaurants. Raleigh-Durham International Airport and other mid-size airports are increasingly offering incentives to airlines for new routes, a move that has been more common among smaller airports. Meanwhile, airports are hustling to contain terminal rent and landing fees, their two main channels of revenue from airlines, while putting more emphasis on other sources. The shift has been ongoing for a decade and is reflected in RDU's budget for the year beginning April 1. The airport's governing board was expected to approve the budget March 28. The idea is that passengers are more willing to pay for such value-added services than for increases in airfares, though some of the money gets passed along to an airport either way. Passengers walking down the concourse will pay $6 for a cup of Starbucks coffee, but then they'll turn around and scream bloody murder when the airline raises fares by $5, said Bob Hertz, CEO of AirlineFinancials.com. Airlines themselves use similar logic, in effect, when they introduce new fees instead of raising base fares. Fees for checked baggage and reservation changes combined accounted for 3.1% of airlines' operating revenue in the first 9 months of 2012, up from 0.8% in 2007. RDU expects to take in about $1 million less in terminal rent from airlines in the coming year, largely because American Airlines is giving up three gates as it reorganizes its operations in bankruptcy. Keeping a lid on rental rates is crucial because the airlines shop around to extent when they decide where to begin or expand routes, RDU Director Michael Langeth says. Meanwhile, RDU raised its daily parking rate by $2 to $12 in early 2012. The increase turned off surprisingly few people from parking, and airport managers forecast 4.2% more revenue from public parking for the coming fiscal year than they did for the year now coming to a close. Public parking is already RDU's single largest source of revenue, accounting for $40.8 million of the $97.6 million in budgeted operating revenue. Concessions revenue is also edging upward, a trend that the airport's Deputy Director for Finance, Joe Stiers, expects to strengthen when a renovated section of Terminal 1 opens in 2014. This week's healthcare column is by Jason DeBruin and is entitled Coordinated Care as Medicaid Remedy. It's from Raleigh. It seems state leaders have no shortage of ideas how to fix Medicaid, and many of the solutions involve a coordinated care model. The North Carolina Department of Health and Human Services asked for suggestions about how to improve the system that spends $14 billion a year on healthcare for mostly poor women and children last year. It received more than 100 responses. These suggestions should not be seen as competing, points out DHHS spokeswoman Julie Henry. After all, these were just requests for information or suggestions for DHHS Secretary Dr. Aldona Wass and Medicaid Director Carol Steckel to consider. They could use one or a combination or, frankly, none of the suggestions submitted. Under the Affordable Care Act, the federal government mandated that states expand the Medicaid program. Later, the U.S. Supreme Court upheld the overall law but allowed states to reject various provisions, including an expansion of Medicaid. In 2012, under the then-Governor Beverly Perdue, the state planned to expand Medicaid to anyone up to 138% of the poverty line. But Republicans in the legislature and Governor Pat McCrory rejected the expansion. That came despite health care leaders, including Dr. Bill Roper, CEO of UNC Healthcare, specifically and repeatedly saying they think a Medicaid expansion, would be in the best interest of the state. Would hospitals benefit from Medicaid expansion? Roper asked rhetorically at a recent UNC Healthcare Board of Directors meeting. Unquestionably, the answer is yes. That's largely because it would give hospitals a way to charge for the care they provide to the neediest patients, which now sometimes ends up written off as bad debt or charity care. UNC Healthcare, along with several hospitals throughout the state, joined forces with the NC Hospital Association to respond to DHHS on improving Medicaid. That group suggested the state operate a new public-private partnership that builds on the existing provider-led care management model to deliver efficient, streamlined, and transparent services. It refers specifically to the model by Community Care of North Carolina, which knits together the medical neighborhood to spread responsibility and care among primary care, subspecialties, and the patient and the payers. The neighborhood partnership will create requirements for data reporting and sharing, develop data analytics to assess population health, and evaluate the effectiveness of the overall Medicaid program, according to the hospital's plan. A 2011 analysis by consultant Milliman Incorporated found that CCNC saved North Carolina nearly $1 billion in health care cost over the four-year period from fiscal year 2007 through fiscal year 2010. In North Carolina, the model is benefiting more than 5,000 providers, 1.2 million patients, and 9 million taxpayers, according to CCNC. And now this week's technology column by Lauren K. Onisorge, Developing a 3D View for Surgeons. This article is from Hillsborough. Behind an inconspicuous door in downtown Hillsborough, medical magic is being perfected. At least, that's the hope of the people behind UNC Chapel Hill spinoff InterOptic, who are developing what they're calling a GPS for surgeons. The company, whose 3D technology was initially researched for the likes of video games, has two official partners, allowing it to expect its first revenue-positive year in 2013. So how did a computer science-backed company get into medical devices? Curtis Keller, a computer science professor at UNC, took a class about starting a business. Keller went with an endoscope with stereo and three-dimensional capabilities. While the technology attracted some grants and mention in some publications, it was too complicated and too expensive. Keller simplified his approach, which led to a success last year when InterOptic Network netted its first royalty partnership with Brentwood, California-based Halt Medical. InterOptic's idea is to use 3D imagery as a tool for surgeons. Surgeons already use ultrasound imaging to help guide laparoscopic procedures, but this 3D system, complete with two screens and 3D glasses, gives a surgeon more control and accuracy. CEO Brian Heaney demonstrates on a model, moving the needle into a prepared body, actually a piece of plastic on a box. The imaging device shows where the needle is and where it will go, with bright lines on the screens to guide the surgeon. Halt Medical, like Nashville-based partner Pathfinder, approached InterOptics for the partnership in which Pathfinder will help sell the technology. Combining our products onto one platform provides surgeons with multiple navigation solutions in performing complex liver interventions and, most importantly, enhancing patient outcomes, says Pathfinder CEO Jim Clore in a statement. The technology has met FDA approval for certain soft tissue indications and has already been used in liver procedures at Carolina's Medical Center in Charlotte. It allows surgeons to target specific areas and could have other indications down the line, particularly in neurosurgery, says Haney. During neurosurgery, however, there's brain swelling, meaning InterOptic will have to figure out a way to account for that change in the imaging. InterOptic hopes to increase its staff this year and may be looking for more space as growing pains are already being felt in the office that used to be an apartment in Hillsborough. In addition to grants, the company raised $100,000 in equity financing in 2008. This week's column about small business is a new kind. Red Hat veterans apply lessons learned to a new kind of firm. This article is by Dale Gibson and is from Raleigh. Get used to it. The times they are changing. Companies no longer are built, communities are, and with communities in place, organizations prosper. That's a lesson learned by four guys deeply involved in creating communities inside and outside of software wunderkind Red Hat, a startup in 1993, with the then dubious idea of giving away software that today is a $1 billion sector leader. Lessons in hand, a new kind of company was launched in 2009. The name was ready-made, NewKind, as was the mission. Adopt the Red Hat model by consulting with organizations to empower employees and customers and any other identified communities to devise mission, culture, and brand. Chris Grahams, one of the NewKind's partners, was Senior Director of Brand Communications and Design at Red Hat, heavily involved in creation of the company's culture, brand, and marketing. Invite people on the journey and they won't reject the destination, he says. Internally, Grahams and the other partners, David Burney, Matthew Munns, and Tom Rabin, jokingly refer to their company as a platypus, that weird animal with parts that don't seem to match. The work of NewKind is really not that messy, nor is it that complicated. Essentially, it's a marketing and branding agency driven by principles of design, motorized by vehicles of discussion involving interested audiences to build a consensus on the culture and identity of an organization. Community Catalyst is a more kind description they have for their work. Once a company's culture and its communities are identified, all forms of media are used to spread the word. Facebook, YouTube, Twitter, newspapers, broadcasts, you name it. Facebook and all the rest are all about communities, says Grahams, adding, nobody is as smart as everybody. Missing, for the most part, from NewKind's arsenal is advertising. It's not that advertising is bad, says Grahams, who has written a book entitled The Ad-Free Brand. We just believe there's a better way. Munns says, we work to get everyone on board to embrace the future. Much as Red Hat software has been developed as open source, meaning customers and Red Hat team members alike own the product, NewKind seeks to empower the fill-in-the-blank, customers, employees, potential customers, to be on board. It's a mashup, explains Grahams, of design thinking and open source thinking. We work to build communities with customers and audiences in a more effective way, says Burney. It worked at Red Hat with very little advertising. With their knowledge, Burney, Grahams, and Rabin left Red Hat, the first being Burney in 2008, the last being Rabin in 2011. Munns worked as a consultant at Red Hat, where he got to know his current partners. We felt we could do it anywhere, and we have, says Grahams. Of his experience with NewKind, which was hired to help with the launch of the Contemporary Art Museum in downtown Raleigh, CAM Chairman Raven Menuccio says they led a complicated process that produced outstanding results. It was very apparent from the start they were very invested in our success. The NewKind partners have built a company with 10 full-time employees and revenue topping $1 million in 2012. They target the clients with which they want to work, preferring those with leaders who can think into the future. The client list includes Lenovo, Centennial Campus, Redwoods, and Bandwidth.com. Burney says the company is growing at a rate of 20% a year and is self-funded with no debt. For the future, the immediate goal is to grow the client list. Longer term, Burney sees new companies being spun out of NewKind's work. We all left great jobs to be able to take this journey, says Rabin. We wanted to build a great team. This week's Washington Watch by Kent Hoover. Mr. Kent Hoover is the chief of Triangle Business Journal's Washington Bureau. The Senate gave retailers and state governments a symbolic victory in their fight to collect sales taxes on Internet purchases. By a 75-24 vote, the Senate passed an amendment to its budget resolution that would allow states to collect taxes on online purchases made by their residents. Websites currently are required to collect sales taxes only for states where they have a physical presence. The budget bill isn't binding, but the big vote in favor of the Marketplace Fairness Act builds momentum for the legislation. Retailers contend the bill is needed to level the playing field between bricks-and-mortar retailers and online sellers. The overwhelming bipartisan vote in the Senate is proof positive that the federal government's special treatment of online-only retailers will soon be a thing of the past, said Sandy Kennedy, president of the Retail Industry Leaders Association. The National Governors Association issued a statement that contended the vote showed that the time has come for passage of this bill. Next, the medical device industry won a victory when the Senate voted 79-20 to repeal a 2.3% excise tax on medical devices. The vote isn't binding, but the lopsided margin dealt a blow to one of the new taxes imposed to pay for health care reform. Democrats in states with strong medical device industries, such as Minnesota, joined Republicans in voting to repeal this tax. The tax went into effect in January and already has cost companies $388 million, according to the Medical Device Manufacturers Association. The tax is a drain on innovation, on job creation, and on our ability to provide groundbreaking medical innovations to patients, says Senator Orrin Hatch of Utah, who is the ranking Republican on the Senate Finance Committee, which has jurisdiction over tax legislation. That committee's chairman, Senator Max Baucus, Democrat of Montana, voted against the amendment, as did Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid, Democrat of Nevada. That means getting a binding vote to repeal the tax remains an uphill battle. And finally, the Pentagon announced it will hold off on sending furlough notices to hundreds of thousands of civilian employees. The Pentagon had planned to cut workers' schedules and pay to only 4 days a week in order to cope with the $85 billion in across-the-board cuts to federal spending that kicked in March 1st. More than half of these cuts, known as sequestration, hit the defense budget. Now, the Pentagon is taking another look at its furlough plans thanks to a separate spending bill just passed by Congress, which moved $10 billion into Department of Defense Operation and Maintenance account. As a result, the Pentagon may not have to cut back workers' hours as much as it originally thought. This week's Editor's Notebook is by Sugata Mukherjee, and he is the editor of the Triangle Business Journal. His column is entitled, Caring Beyond Dollars and Cents. In the past few days, I read about how Warren Buffett gets paid $100,000 from his own company, Berkshire Hathaway Incorporated, and then cuts a check for $50,000 to the company to reimburse Berkshire for postage and phone calls that are personal. I also followed a Twitter thread of Bill Gates on how he was retweeting Michael Pollan's tweets on food alternatives, food system sustainability, and to some extent, hunger issues. And so that I do not lose track of what Virgin Airline founder Richard Branson is doing, I read the letter Branson wrote to Maldives President Mohamed Wahid Hassan, and how Branson urged the president to reverse a decision by the country's court that sentenced a 15-year-old rape victim to be flogged with 100 lashes. What do Buffett, Gates, and Branson have in common? Their sense of responsibility, place, and their sense of how influential they can be in changing things for the better. There is no doubt being uber-rich and prominent makes it easier for them to constantly be in the limelight, but one does have to be rich in the limelight to do the right thing. The Great Recession, I believe, has misaligned some of the values of our executives, who now may be engulfed in a vicious cycle of greed, profitability, me first, and shareholder investor value. Why? Because the 3 years between 2008 and 2011 got so bad for some that they have vowed never to be in that situation again. Hence, these executives are working harder than ever, but making sure they don't spend too much money to grow their businesses. Profitability is the name of the game. While there's nothing wrong with making more money and hiring more people, one should not have to sacrifice one set of values for another to reach a set of goals. Reading what influential people, such as Buffett, Gates, and Branson do on a daily basis may look like showboating to some, but they are missing the point. The hidden collateral damage left by this latest recession is the worst I have ever seen since the day I started writing about business some 25 years ago. If we have gotten harder, we need to soften up. If we have become rigid, we need to be more flexible. If we are more apathetic than ever, We need to care. This week's guest opinion column is from Christopher Hill. Mr. Hill is the Director of Education and Law Project at the North Carolina Justice Center in Raleigh. It's entitled, Homeschool Bills and Legislature Could Harm Public Education. If anyone should know about the desperate need for more resources for public education in North Carolina, you would think it would be current or former school board members. Having grappled with the challenges that confront our overworked and underpaid educators on a regular basis, these individuals would presumably get it that siphoning off even more funds from public school is a disastrous prescription. Unfortunately, some such folks seem to have looked right past this obvious reality. Right now, for instance, lawmakers and the General Assembly, including some former school board members, are sponsoring bills that would drain money from public schools. These destructive proposals include House Bill 144, which provides tax credits for families that homeschool their children, and House Bill 230, which amends the definition of a homeschool. House Bill 144 provides $1,250 per semester to homeschool parents. There are about 80,000 students who are homeschooled in the state. If each student receives $2,500 per year, the state will lose $20 million. In a time when North Carolina ranks 48th in the nation in per pupil spending, sponsors of this bill are apparently more than willing to allow the situation to degrade further. Worse, House Bill 144 does not require parents who receive the credits to spend the money on education. There would be nothing to stop a homeschooling family from buying a large television or making a down payment on a car. Public schools have to be accountable for every penny they spend. This bill makes no financial sense. While homeschool students are required to take national standardized tests, there is no requirement they achieve any particular score. In other words, the $2,500 per year would go to people who do not have to show any academic growth or success. Our legislature is considering paying teachers for performance, i.e. students' success on standardized tests, so it seems downright surreal lawmakers would provide money to parents who have no accountability whatsoever. As if the accountability is not low enough, House Bill 230 amends the definition of homeschools. Currently, the North Carolina Division of Non-Public Education regulates them. House Bill 230 states parents will determine the scope and sequence of academic instruction. Put bluntly, it seems as if the intent of the bill is to make schools that are already largely unaccountable even less so. And while parents determining the specifics of what their children learn in homeschools is an accepted and established concept, the idea that they will have a carte blanche takes things to a new and problematic level. These homeschool bills are supposed to provide educational choices for parents, particularly those with low incomes. The proposed tax credit, however, is too small to be of any real assistance for low-income parents. If the legislature really wanted to help low-income parents, it would fund schools so that North Carolina would not rank 48th in per pupil spending and 46th in teacher pay. These proposals, sadly, are just two of the 1,000 cuts planned to create a private schools with public money, a plan that will help for-profit corporations take funding from public schools under the guise of choice. Providing money to homeschool parents may seem like a harmless endeavor, but when combined with plans to provide vouchers by calling them scholarship grants to drain off millions of dollars to for-profit corporations running charter schools, the danger becomes obvious. It's especially sad this process is being abetted by people who should know better. It's lights out on the Duke University campus where 1,460 streetlight bulbs will be replaced with LED bulbs as part of the school's effort to be climate neutral by 2024. Besides the desire to be green, there's this statistic that has to be of interest to the bean counters at Duke. The LED bulbs will save the university $188,000 in operational and energy costs annually because they last longer and use less energy. GTM Research has selected 10 companies as all-star performers in the smart grid industry, and it turns out that 6 of them have a significant presence in the Triangle. They are ABB Limited, Cisco Systems Incorporated, IBM Corporation, Itron Incorporated, Siemens AG, and Schneider Electric SA. Admittedly, most of those are gigantic companies with dozens of offices around the world, but their smart grid operations are indeed heavily focused here. Siemens Smart Grid Division's main U.S. locations are in Wendell, Minnetonka, Minnesota, and the San Francisco Bay Area, for example. And ABB's North American headquarters is in Cary. Given the cool spring we've had so far, here's hoping things warm up in time for North Carolina Beer Month, which is April. Durham is planning to celebrate the occasion on April 3rd with an event called Cola Beer Nation, in which 3 of the city's breweries will be offering up their brews at the corner of Magnum and Paris Streets in downtown. The breweries, which will donate $1 from each pint sold to charity, are Bull City Burger and Brewery, Full Steam Brewery, and Triangle Brewing Company. Brewmasters from each shop have blended their styles together to create a beer for the occasion. Hope to see you there. The Triangle real estate community lost a major advocate on March 20th when a longtime lieutenant in the York Real Estate Company's Joe Kalkers passed away at the age of 73. He was a senior vice president at York Properties in Raleigh and helped start the company's commercial division years ago. Kalkhurst mentored dozens of residential and commercial real estate professionals in the Triangle throughout his career, including Raleigh developer Carter Worthy and Phyllis Brookshire, leader of Allen Tate Company's residential real estate operations in the Triangle. Of him, Worthy had this to say, "Joe was one of a kind. He either loved you or he didn't, and I was lucky to be in that first group. He was my mentor, a brilliant negotiator, patient and persistent, and he knew exactly when to make the close. I learned a lot from Joe, and so did dozens of other Yorkies over the 30-plus years he worked here at York Properties." We've run out of time for this week's edition of the Triangle Business Journal. Be sure to listen at the same time next week. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Al Reynolds, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. This program will be available online at trianglereadingservice.org immediately after the broadcast. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. So long until next time.